I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. Nish is still buried somewhere under moving boxes and the impressive amount of snow that's still on the ground out in Idaho. She'll be back next week, but for this show, I'm joined by guest co-host and superstar religion journalist Jack Jenkins. Jack is a reporter for Religion News Service, and he's also a fellow alum of Harvard Divinity School. We will try our best not to nerd out this week, but we can't make any promises. We'll be talking in this show about the involvement of religious groups in anti-gun violence efforts, the surprising trend of journalists and liberals going toe-to-toe with conservatives on religion in the media, and how Christian colleges are grappling with a new generation of out gay students. Before we begin, I want to express heartfelt thanks on behalf of myself and Nish to those of you who've decided to support Impolite Company by becoming monthly patrons. If you like what we're doing here, you can click the link in your player's episode description or visit patreon.com/impolitecompanypodcast to sign up. It couldn't be easier, and we'd be so grateful if you'd be willing to invest in the future of our show for as little as just $1 a month. So, Jack, I thought we would start off by jumping into a topic that you had a chance to report out in person last weekend. Everybody knows about the March for Our Lives and the kind of local marches that took place around the country. But you were actually there on the ground and also at the prayer service the night before at the Washington Cathedral. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your focus, which was looking for specific kinds of groups that were there and involved in the march.
Right. So I'll be honest, when my editor assigned me this story, saying, okay, you have to find the religion angle for the March for Our Lives, I had assumed that this would have been one of those stories where you make three phone calls, you get three quotes, you throw around some context, and you put it up. And instead, I was overwhelmed with the response from people of faith and faith communities who were actively participating either locally in their own state or their own solidarity march, or who were literally busing people to the March for Our Lives in D.C. Mm-hmm. So I, for instance, I knew about the cathedral's vigil, the Washington National Cathedral's vigil, the evening before. And so I planned on attending, but I wasn't prepared for what happened when I got there, which was that this massive group of people had showed up to attend. And the vigil itself included a wide array of faith groups. It was an interfaith vigil. So you had Christians and Muslims and Sikhs and Hindus and Buddhists and, folks from the Washington Ethical Society, all in the same space, talking about gun violence. And you had, survivors of the Charleston church shooting from 2015. You had a pastor who lost her mother in that shooting. She spoke. You had parents who'd lost children in other contexts of gun violence, and you had the parents of a Parkland victim who the last night they apparently spent with their daughter was at church because she was the president of her youth group. And they spoke about the horrors of gun violence and how a refrain we heard often is that prayers are not enough, like prayers need to be followed with action. And this was said in a worshiping space, and it was a really, really interesting and profound gathering that we got to watch, where the religious language that is often used by lawmakers around the issue of gun violence, the whole thoughts and prayers controversy, was inverted by bishops and priests and pastors and imams, speaking, saying very clearly, our different faith communities are affected by this, whether they're, students who are at Parkland or, kids who are shot in other contexts. I think you had in Chicago youth speaking, you had some other youth who had, lost who had been connected to the new, not youth, but other folks who had been connected to the Newtown shooting. You started to see how wide of a reach this issue really has, and how many faith communities have been a part of it for some time. So that was just the vigil. I mean, that was just the night before.
Right. Yeah. And just a note before you move on to the march itself, it's significant, I think, that the Washington Cathedral has had such a major role in kind of being a convener here, because this has been something that the folks there have been involved with for years. In fact, I'm trying to remember, unfortunately, there have been, as we all know, so many mass shootings that it's hard to keep them straight. But I want to say that after the Newtown massacre, that there was also an interfaith gathering at the cathedral that included a moment of silence with, like, you know, a bell ringing for each victim. And at that time, and that was, what, 5 years ago or more now, there were religious leaders from across the spectrum calling for policy changes. And as you say, you know, acknowledging that, of course, we're people of faith, we pray, but prayers are not sufficient for this. And especially for Christians, that nowhere in the Bible does it say, you know, you just pray and then there's nothing expected of you. So it's just, I think, a credit to the cathedral that they have kept up their involvement with this and really been a convener. I saw that Rob Schenck's organization, the Bonhoeffer Institute, was involved with the vigil. And they also had him in on a Sunday morning a few years ago to preach the Sunday sermon, which was really kind of fascinating on just, you know, a regular Sunday morning worship service.
Right. And to your point, one thing that sort of became clear in my reporting was the faith community is no stranger to the gun violence debate. You know, even going back farther than Newtown, there's been a lot of hyper-local efforts to reduce gun violence by faith communities, often because, and it's been said to me when doing stories on this, I mean, pastors are the ones that officiate the funerals for gun violence deaths. I mean, this has always been something that has touched their work. And so, but to your point, after Newtown, the dean of the cathedral actually delivered a sermon in which he included the line that the gun lobby is no match for the cross lobby. And they had, you know, a national day where faith communities across the country, you know, kind of discussed the issue in church, you know, one Sunday morning. I believe it might have been interfaith, so it might have been several different groups. I can't remember exactly. But there was all of this interfaith work around 2012 and 2013 on this issue, and there was hope that the faith community could be the tipping point and help, you know, push a change in legislation on this topic. And that didn't happen. But what I found in my reporting, you know, this past weekend was that these networks, these faith-based networks around the issue of gun violence, you know, have been reactivated by the youth. I found out that many of the people who attended the march, you know, these faith communities, were often did so at the urging of their youth. I had one pastor from Historically Black Church in Vienna, Virginia, tell me that, you know, they first really caught wind of this because one of their high school youth came to the church and said, "Hey, look, I'm going to go to this, whether or not you want me to, but I would really like it if my church could come too." And so, you know, they had, you know, other youth stand up during worship services and ask other participants of the church to come. And you saw that theme kind of, you know, work itself into a lot of the things that I saw the day of the march. I mean, the first event I attended was this gathering put on by the Union for Reform Judaism. And they had 3,000 people there.
Wow.
And, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz spoke to the group. They had, you know, Parkland survivors talk to the group. I got to interview one of the Parkland youth. They were there. It's worth remembering that, you know, several of the victims of the shooting were Jewish, and that synagogue actually sponsored one of the lobbying days on the Hill in the Florida legislature from the students. And so they've been actively involved in this. But, you know, I kept seeing, you know, that most of the speakers at that event were under 20. And when I went to the next event, which was an interfaith vigil all the way across town, you know, the victim of gun violence couldn't have been older than 30. You know, when he was a Muslim gun violence victim, when he spoke to the crowd, he was young as well. And, you know, about half the people who were in these crowds were high schoolers or younger. And I'm used to going to these events and seeing, you know, these kind of older protesters, but that was definitely inverted for the stuff I saw this past weekend.
That's fascinating. And I wonder, one of the things we talk about a lot on the podcast is one of the debates, particularly in more conservative churches these days, is the idea that, oh, we shouldn't bring politics into the church, that somehow squashes out the room for the gospel, and that it's an either or. You're either, you know, worshiping God or you're playing politics, which, you know, we can set aside what conservative religious folks have been doing for the last 4 decades or so when it comes to politics. But it's so interesting that the younger generation just has no patience for those kinds of debates that maybe their parents and their grandparents' generations are still kind of stuck in. And it's just kind of, this is important. And I care about it as a person of faith as well as just a person. And so we should do this. Mm-hmm. No debate about it.
I'll note, you know, actually during the rally, the March for Our Lives, when these like Goliath, you know, gaggle of people were around that stage, one of the speakers from Chicago, one of the Chicago youth, just threw 2 scripture references at the close of his speech as if, you know, without, you know, everyone participating. He, at the end, he was basically preaching to this crowd because for him, the issue of gun violence and his faith are, you know, the idea that would be too political, that clearly to this, you know, young man, his faith was a part of his activism. There was no in between. And so the idea of you can't be political and religious, you know, that was not what was activated on stage that day. And you kept seeing that again and again. I saw a lot of, you know, signs like faith over firearms that people would hold up. People would have scripture references on their signs. And then something I would also see, to your point about activism, you know, how convenient it is to say that we don't want to have politics, faith in our politics at one moment, and then another moment it's different. There was a lot of signs that said, you know, you call yourself pro-life. And that was clearly directed at conservatives who might be anti-abortion, but might not be speaking up about the gun violence debate. And my understanding is that, you know, some of the speakers even referenced this as a pro-life issue. That's something that actually a spokesperson for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops about 4 or 5 years ago during that previous era of activism around here, you know, actually said that to be consistently pro-life is to support stricter gun control laws and to that effect. So, you know, we kind of pick and choose when we decide that politics doesn't need to be involved in our faith doesn't need to be involved in our politics.
Yeah. It's really interesting. You bring up the pro-life angle. There was an article on, Christianity Today this week, written by a Chicago area pastor who had gone to the March for Life around the Roe v. Wade anniversary in D.C. that takes place every January, and had also gone to the Chicago March for Our Lives. And he was kind of, elbowing his fellow evangelicals to say, you know, the March for Life is full of Christians. That's basically everybody who's there. But I didn't see a heck of a lot of evangelicals at the March for Our Lives. And why is that? Like, aren't these both life issues? And what's the difference here?
Right. I will caveat that by, I know some of the conversation about that article was that he included a line saying that there weren't that many Christians there. And I know for a fact for the Chicago gathering that there were churches that had gathered before and then walked over there to attend. But it sounded like, to your point, he was speaking to his fellow evangelicals.
Yeah, and I think he was a little too vague in his wording, but he was definitely calling out the folks who would have been at the March for Life.
And statistically, you know, we see that discrepancy. There was a 2013 poll from the Public Religion Research Institute, which, again, is you know, it's a little bit of old data, but that survey found that the only major the outlier among major faith groups when it came to gun control legislation was white evangelical Protestants. Mm-hmm. Pretty much every other Virtually every other major faith group in the United States in that poll, a majority supported stricter gun control laws, with the exception of white evangelical Protestants. And I think, you know, it's also kind of telling, you know, the different reactions to, say, the Sutherland Church shooting and compared to this Parkland shooting. I mean, when that Sutherland Church shooting happened, you had people like Robert Jeffress, you know, a Texas pastor who was also a faith advisor to President Donald Trump. You know, he went on Fox News and was talking about how his church, about he claimed a third to a half are armed at any given time, and that, you know, effectively advocating for allowing open carry in churches. And so you have, you know, that again, kind of the idea that the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good churchgoer with a gun, I guess. And that is in direct contrast to other churches, both in Texas and in other southern states, where there have been laws passed recently that allow for people to carry guns in church, except if the church puts up a sign barring firearms inside that worshiping community. And a lot of worshiping communities in Texas and Georgia and others have done that specifically as like an alternative to, you know, letting not security personnel, but average churchgoers arm themselves. So there just seemed to be a chasm of difference in how these various faith communities respond to this issue.
Yeah, I would say that's quite different. I bet you didn't see a whole lot of churches marching last weekend saying, we want to be able to arm ourselves in our sanctuaries.
Yeah, there wasn't. I didn't. If they were there, I did not see their signs.
I think you would have noticed that.
Right, right. I would note that one of Trump's faith advisors, Tony Suarez, who is part of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, he did note on Twitter that his own children had participated in the walkout. And so there does seem to be, I would be curious to see if there's a generational divide as well in terms of older evangelicals versus younger evangelicals about, you know, how they feel about this issue.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great if we could get pollsters to focus on that, Jack? That's one of our ongoing pet peeves, but we'll leave that for another day, perhaps. Well, I wanted to move next to another story that is related to the March for Our Lives, but I hadn't thought of as a religious story until you tagged it on Twitter, which is the, I don't even know how to describe this, because the only word that comes to mind is deplorable. And I realized that Hillary Clinton got, you know, just attacked up one way and down the other for using that phrase in the 2016 campaign. But what else do you call people who are ridiculing and mocking kids whose friends and teachers were just slaughtered in an attack that they survived? I don't know what else to call it.
Yeah, it has drawn a significant backlash. And it's not just Laura Ingraham, who I believe you're referencing here. There has been a systemic series of articles criticizing David Hogue. I don't know if you heard Red State, which, you know, is associated with Eric Erickson. Had an article like claiming that David wasn't, you know, at the school during the shooting, and then they had to complete, like, after multiple updates, had to completely strike through the entire article because it proved to be false. I mean, there has been a lot of criticism of these Parkland students from conservative commentators and outlets, like a systemic, you know, ongoing litany of articles about, you know, their person, which it really seems like politically an interesting strategy, to say the least. And if Laura is any indication, not a particularly successful one.
No. And there, you know, we're talking about the fact that, again, these savvy Parkland students have focused on her advertisers, and that was somewhat effective. She came out, and we're recording this on Friday. She came out yesterday, I believe, and issued something that could be called an apology to David Hogue. And I want to get to that. But first, this Red State article is one that I was thinking of. Just because, you know, one of the ongoing problems in our journalism field is people wanting to be first instead of wanting to be right with stories. And so it was thrown up before, because it wouldn't have taken very much to determine that, in fact, yes, he was at school. And that they'd seen a clip that was a little out of context and made it seem like maybe he wasn't. But even if they weren't able to figure that out quickly, wouldn't you think that you would err on the side of not attacking the teenager who, again, survived a massacre that, even if he wasn't there, killed 17 of his friends and fellow students and teachers? I'm not going to go off into the coarsening of our culture, but it just seems like common sense and human decency would advise that you just err on the side of compassion there.
And it's a really interesting journalistic decision. I remember what was most interesting, revealing to me was that I believe that there was an interview with Erickson after this debacle, after the article had been retracted. For the record, the author of the piece has now written effectively an apology piece saying that she was wrong and she's sorry. But Eric Erickson doubled down on his criticism of David Hogue. He said, the article might be inaccurate, but he still considers this student, I believe the term is bully.
Yeah, he calls him a bully.
That's
from Eric Erickson.
So it's one of those things where, as a journalist, you've been in journalism for longer than I have. It's fascinating to me how that series of decisions would get made in a newsroom, right? Like, how would you decide to do this story that quickly without, acknowledging the risks, and then after the fact give an interview in which you still defame it just seems like an interesting series of decisions regarding, how that would reflect on the credibility of, what your publishing outlet. Like, I just don't, like, it doesn't seem like a really sound, thought out way of approaching journalism or really the issue. And if it worked in reverse, I feel like the conservatives would have been rightly outraged at liberals if they ever did the same thing. And it's just a really, really curious decision.
Yeah. Well, I think you could argue at some of these conservative outlets that inflaming liberals is precisely what they want to do to get their readers excited. That's a decision that they can make. It doesn't seem to have worked out terribly well for them this time. And there's also, and this is the ongoing question for journalists, but you're a journalist and you're also a human being. So again, running a story, especially one that you haven't completely, made waterproof, maybe you hold on to that for a little bit, just as a human being. But that's just my suggestion. So where this intersects with religion is we once again are finding a case where conservatives always like to pull out Bible verses. But they're finding increasingly that the folks that they are going after can quote the Bible right back at them. And I'll throw out a couple more examples after you go through the Twitter exchange here.
Right. Laura Ingraham tweeted about, David Hogue apparently not getting into every college he applied to, which, welcome to the experience of applying to colleges. Like, that doesn't seem to be something you would besmirch anyone for, much less someone who's a victim of gun violence. But then he responded by, saying, here are her list of advertisers. And sure enough, a couple of them dropped. And she then issued an apology. And in her apology, she said, in the spirit of Holy Week, upon reflection, maybe this was, effectively she said, maybe this wasn't the best idea, et cetera, et cetera. And so several things happened after that. One, don't know if you saw David Hogue actually in his response, you know, effectively said he doesn't see this as an apology unless she apologizes for other things the network has done. And, you know, said, you know, this is about love thy neighbor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he referenced scripture, you know, in the same exchange, another religion part of the exchange. And then, you know, her reference to in the spirit of Holy Week got picked up by a lot of progressive religious circles and just, you know, religious circles in general. And for a little while, the hashtag in the spirit of Holy Week was starting to be used by progressive religious leaders saying, you know, in the spirit of Holy Week, things like, you know, guns are bad. And in the spirit of Holy Week, like, I can't believe you did this, you know, things like that. And it just became this really, I think there is a moment that we're in where, like you say, I think there is a presumption among many conservatives and also just America writ large that biblical literacy and religious literacy is something that is owned by conservatives. And that, at least in my reporting, has never been the case. And it's certainly not the case in, you know, in political debates these days, and doesn't seem to be the case in this gun violence debate either. So kind of this became not only a debate about, you know, whether you should, like you said, about whether you should besmirch the student, but then also a theological debate. Because, you know, also, it's also not totally clear. I'd be curious if you have any reflections on this, by when she says in the spirit of Holy Week, that's why, you know, she's, apologizing. Like, it's not totally clear to me in my study of Christian tradition what that means. Like, does that mean, like, this has to do with Christ's crucifixion? Like, I don't really know what the theological argument is there. But yeah, that was the exchange that became rapidly more religious as time went on.
Yeah. So there were a couple of other examples this week by journalists having some religious literacy, which, as we know, is sometimes surprising, but also can be a bad rap. So there was an evangelical pastor, Greg Locke, who was... basically going after Stormy Daniels around the time of her 60 Minutes interview, saying, yeah, well, he's the president, but you're still a hooker, which she's not. But setting that aside, not a very Christian thing to do. And Jake Tapper, in a series of tweets, basically tweets Luke 7 at him, which is the story of the woman who comes to the house where Jesus is staying and washes his feet and brings him expensive perfume and basically uses her hair and her feet to wash his feet, and is told off by a Pharisee who says, you know, she's wasting this. This could be used to help the poor. And is also telling off Jesus, saying, you know, if you knew what kind of a woman she was, you wouldn't want her doing this. And Jesus says, you know, I'll tell you, she will be in heaven before you are. That was pretty effective. The pastor didn't really know what to say to that. And it kind of on the similar topic this week, Chris Hayes had David Brody from the Christian Broadcasting Network, who has a spiritual hagiography of Trump out in bookstores right now. And he was explaining that, you know, evangelicals don't have a problem with a president who might have had an affair with or who might have, because from her description, it's not an affair. He basically took advantage of and possibly inappropriately used his position of power to have sex with her. But that they could forgive that because of this thing called grace that Christians believe in. And Brody was being pretty condescending to Chris, who grew up in the church and shot right back, you know, I learned that there's no such thing as cheap grace and that you don't get it without without repenting of your sins and asking for forgiveness. And that is something not only has Trump not done, but he has proclaimed that he is, you know, perhaps the only person who has no need to repent or ask for forgiveness. So it does feel like far from being cowed. I don't want to say we're in a new era, but there's definitely something different happening where some folks on the right can't just stand up and spout religious ideas or spout scripture without being challenged on it.
I would agree. I mean, it's certainly something I've seen in my reporting. And also to your point, the argument, you know, around Stormy Daniels, and Brody isn't the only person to say that. I mean, Jerry Falwell Jr., president of Liberty University, said something similar a few weeks ago. You know, he was more referring to this. He was still saying, you know, these are allegations about Stormy Daniels, et cetera. But, you know, broadly, he also made a similar argument about forgiveness. Well, what's interesting is that most observers of the religious right is that traditionally that has been an argument they have used, but it usually does include some sort of confession of sins or ask for forgiveness on the part of, you know, the allegedly guilty party. And Trump is an interesting outlier in that he in rare form hasn't said anything about Stormy Daniels on Twitter, which is atypical, but also, you know, hasn't come out and said, you know, these happened and I, you know, as a broken, fallen human being, I ask for forgiveness, which is typically, you know, the narrative. So it is a really interesting moment because this has consistently been the way theologically conservative religious leaders have approached politicians who might behave in ways that would otherwise be condemned. But Trump doesn't give them the end of that story. That it requires the request for forgiveness. And if you fall into what I've heard some allude to is say, well, you know, we don't know what's in his heart. Like, he could be asking for forgiveness in his heart. But if that is true, then that can be applied to literally anyone, right? Because, you know, you can never know if they've asked for forgiveness in their heart. And so why ever, you know, condemn certain behavior? So Trump has really made things complicated for traditional arguments among a subset of Christian conservatives when it comes to this sort of stuff.
Well, he's either made things complicated or he's made things very, very clear, finally, that there are lines and they are partisan lines or team lines, really. If you're on our team, the rules don't apply. If you're on the other team, well, you know, I'm still old enough to remember Bill Clinton finally, after like 7 painful months in the Lewinsky saga, coming public with a self-abasing apology, for which he was mocked by conservative evangelicals who thought he was overdoing it and he was being obnoxious and bringing in ministers. Like, why is he doing this? It's so performative. Somebody had written somewhere, and I wish I could remember who so I could give them credit, that when it comes to evangelicals and what they believe to be true about Trump's faith, it really is faith is hope for things not seen, because we don't see, we don't hear anything when it comes to him. But they have imputed to him a certain kind of Christian faith that you would just have to have your own faith actually exists. But before we go too long here, I want to move on to our third topic, which I hadn't been thinking about this before, but when you brought up during our discussion about the March for Our Lives, the distinction between older evangelicals and younger evangelicals, it completely applies here in this third topic, which is about Christian colleges and the difficulties they're having with LGBT policies. And they're having difficulties because a few decades ago, if you were a kid going to a Christian college and you realized you were gay, you probably didn't say anything. Or if you did, you told a couple friends and you swore them to secrecy. Now we're in an age where there are out gay students on Christian campuses. And Christian campuses where students and faculty have to sign statements of faith agreeing with the particular approach to sexual ethics and definitions of marriage and rejection of homosexual activity that the school kind of sets out as part of its identity, and they're not agreeing. Or, you know, they in large numbers are disagreeing with older generations of evangelicals for whom this was just part of what it meant to be an evangelical. And now there's a whole generation standing up and saying, yeah, no, that does not matter to us. Or if it does, it certainly isn't enough of a priority for us to turn it around and wield it in a way that hurts our friends and our classmates.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, some of the more telling moments around that came after the signing of the Nashville Statement last year, when all these different conservative leaders, some of whom are never Trumpers, et cetera, just the broader swath of conservative evangelicalism signed this statement about, sexual ethics and included kind of a condemnation of homosexuality, and arguably, and depending on who you ask among the signers, did draw a line in the sand, effectively saying, that if you do not side with this conservative vision of sexual ethics, this condemnation of homosexual relationships, then you don't really count as a Christian, and which is, defining, defining the faith that way. And what
I think the statement or the phrase was, this is not a matter on which we can agree to disagree, or on which there can be disagreement at all.
Exactly. And, which is a really interesting statement from, a variety of perspectives. But what early reporting indicated was that they got a lot of pushback from younger evangelicals. Even, if I recall correctly, like Rod Dreher at the American Conservative, who wrote The Benedict Option, which is, the book that kind of advocates for a retreat from elements of society, is sparked by this debate over same-sex marriage. Evangelicals and conservative Christians retreating from society. And he talked about how he had heard from readers that this is not going over well mm-hmm. with a lot of young evangelicals who just simply don't see the faith that way. I've seen these divisions repeatedly where, they either vehemently disagree with the theology of their predecessors, these younger evangelicals, saying that, this isn't something that I define my faith on. Like, homosexuality is something we can see as, we can affirm that and still be people of faith. Or they just don't care that much. Like, they just don't agree that it's a thing that they can't agree to disagree about, right? And so that does seem to be a growing chasm in white evangelical Christian communities. And it's not really clear when that's going to, become a big issue. Because at some point, a lot of these younger evangelicals are going to become pastors and have been kicked out of, say, the Southern Baptist Convention, or kind of cleaved from the evangelical herd when they become affirming. And, what happens if that becomes a sizable subset of the evangelical churches? And now you have groups like, what is it, Church Clarity, where they're trying to force churches on record, like, are you affirming or are you not affirming, so that, people are able to kind of Google and find out if the church they're going to, where they stand on this issue, which in most of the churches that they're doing this to, of course, are that they're researching are evangelical churches. I mean, this is clearly a live issue for a big part of young evangelicalism.
Yeah, well, and we've talked about Church Clarity a bunch on this podcast because, I know it has a lot of conservative critics. And the reason is not that they are calling out churches that are non-affirming. It's that they're making churches pick. And a lot of these evangelical churches, specifically because, as you point out, they need young evangelicals in the pews, they would rather leave it a little fuzzy and leave enough room that you don't quite know. You think you know where they stand, but they're not going to actually like put it down in writing. And so this is really threatening for a lot of them. But as you say, not addressing it now just means kicking it down the road, because there will be a new generation of pastors, and some of them will continue the kind of old line approach. But many of them will not, in part just because they have people in their lives who they do not want to turn their backs on. And because the networks of gay Christians themselves are growing much larger and supportive and more visible. And it's becoming impossible to ignore that gay Christians are part of the church, and in many places are holding up the church, are leading churches.
Right, and I have a live question that I don't know the answer to. I'll defer to you if you have any firm answers to this. But I'm actually curious if a lot of these young evangelicals, if they are gay themselves or if they are LGBTQ affirming, do they stay with the evangelical tradition and then try to, forge their own version of it? Or do they leave and sit in the back of Episcopal churches or Presbyterian churches or something like that to, and kind of create a culture in exile, if that makes sense? Mm-hmm. And it's not immediately clear to me where they land. I mean, have you seen, know anything about the refugees from evangelicalism? Or do you think they're going to stay in the fold?
I think more people are leaving than are staying. I mean, it's only really, really recently that you've begun to see kind of pockets of out gay evangelicals even speaking up. There are some folks who are, as you say, trying to stay in the tradition and kind of fight within. But I would say there are many, many more who are leaving. It's kind of akin to when folks started leaving the Catholic Church and many moved over to Episcopalians because, come on, we're pretty close in the Episcopal Church. When I was in the process of thinking that I could be Episcopalian and joining the church, I went to a new member class and they went around the room and half of the people there were former Catholics. Who just couldn't, either because they wanted to be in a tradition that ordained women, or they had differences with the theology around homosexuality, or any number of reasons. The sex abuse scandals, obviously, just were leaving the Catholic Church but didn't want to leave religion behind. And I think you could also point to the rise of non-denominational churches that used to be a very conservative area for churches. And now you see more and more kind of hipster, quasi-evangelical, we're not going to give ourselves a name or denominational affiliation there, but kinds of churches starting up, especially in urban spaces, that have younger congregations, younger pastors, and could be maybe a third way forward here. I don't know enough about some of the newer groups like the offshoots of Grapevine churches and those. But we could see new denominational structures that emerge to support those. I hope so anyway. Because I would hate for it to just be the old tradition or you got to leave.
Right.
Okay. To wrap up the show, Jack, every week we like to leave our listeners with a recommendation, a TV show, a movie, maybe some music. What do you have for us this week?
I have two. I'm a science fiction fan. That's a part of me.
Yeah,
I am one of those. And I'm reading this trilogy that's called the Three Body Problem trilogy. It got a big deal because it won a Hugo Award and it got a lot of attention because Barack Obama confessed to reading it when he was in having fights with Congress because he said it gave perspective. And kept him from he had a cosmic perspective when aliens might invade, it made the little problems in Congress didn't seem as bad. And so I got into it and it's a really interesting book. I don't want to give too much away. It's originally in Chinese, and it's been translated to English. It's by Liu Cixin, the last name, first name gets flipped in Chinese.
Sure.
And it's not – actually, Obama's assessment I roughly agree with, which is that it's not the best character study. Mm-hmm. The characters are interesting, but they are less interesting than this grand cosmic narrative that the author draws. And there's a lot of international politics in it. Religion shows up quite frequently. But it says a lot about the human condition and what it means to be human. And if you can get through the science parts, because it has – it's pretty heavy on the science part of science fiction. I'm on the third book now, and I've really kind of enjoyed kind of the stuff that it deals with. It gets into, you know, the Cultural Revolution in China and then, you know, contemporary America. It's a lot of stuff in there. So now apparently Amazon has reportedly, you know, it might buy the rights to this series for $1 billion.
Oh my goodness.
And so they might make it into a television show. So we might hear more from this series soon. And that's the book recommendation. And the music recommendation is, so I went and saw the Oh Hellos recently. and they're great. They're fun. And I enjoy their shows. I feel very optimistic afterwards. But their opener was this group called Lowland Hum. And I never heard of them before, and they're like super chill. Just I believe they're now a husband and wife couple. And I bought the vinyl of their album Thin, and it's just real minimalist chill music. Religion kind of waves its way in and out of the songs, but it's something that people can enjoy from a variety of perspectives. And when I get stressed by the book that Obama told me wouldn't stress me out. Hey, listen to this music to chill out.
Awesome. Well, thank you. I will definitely look up the music, and I would say I'll read the books, but my like to-do stack of books is already higher than this desk right here. So I'll make a note. So I also have two recommendations this week. I cannot tell you how excited I am for the live musical broadcast of Jesus Christ Superstar, which just crosses so many of my interests in one place. It's an incredible cast with John Legend playing Jesus Christ and Sarah Bareilles playing Mary Magdalene and Alice Cooper coming back in the role of King Herod, which is such an awesome song. Although I have to admit, I know many, many of the songs from the musical, but I have never seen it because I definitely grew up in the era and the evangelical climate where that was heresy. And like, it was bad enough that I was in Godspell in middle school. Like that was still maybe a bridge too far, but Jesus Christ Superstar, that was basically pornography. Even the name of it, I remember like not even wanting to say Jesus Christ Superstar, that was like somehow
wow,
like defaming Jesus or something. So I am very excited on Easter Sunday at age 44 to finally see Jesus Christ Superstar. It's time, I think. But then I also have a music recommendation. This group, I don't even remember how I came across them. Maybe it was somebody's Facebook post, which is why I still love Facebook. I know it's going to go away, but I like it for many things. It's a sister duo, I think from Georgia. They're called Larkin Poe, P-O-E. And they just have the best like bluesy soul rock sound. They're basically exactly what I would want to sound like if I had any ability to be like a Southern rocker. And they have a song, Preachin' Blues, which is just, it's my soundtrack this week. I've just been playing it over and over and over and over. So highly recommend Preachin' Blues if you're, say, down from reading science fiction or from reading the news. Put on some chill music or some rock and blues. Well, thank you so much, Jack, for joining me this week. That is all for this week's episode. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you enjoyed our conversation, please, 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 please rate us on iTunes. It is the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page and consider supporting us financially so we can continue to expand these conversations and maybe even bring a live show to a place near you. As always, we'll post the show notes on our website. And until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.